So with that, I'd like to move to the first item on the agenda, engagement quality review, and I'll turn that over to Greg Skates, who will lead that discussion.
Thank you, Jennifer. As you are aware, soon after the board's creation, the board adopted certain existing standards used by the auditing profession. One such standard was the concurring partner review requirement, which the board continued to apply on a transitional basis to registered firms that were members of the SEC practice section of the AICPA as of April of 2003. Registered accounting firms that were not members of the SEC practice section, those were generally non-U.S. firms and some smaller firms, are not subject to this existing requirement. As part of the board's process of evaluating the existing concurring partner review requirement, the board sought the advice of the Standing Advisory Group on two separate occasions, in June of 2004 and October of 2005. In addition to input received at these SAG meetings, the board considered information on this topic from PCAOB inspections, SEC and PCAOB enforcement cases, and other sources. On February 26th, of last year, of 2008, the board proposed to replace the existing requirement with a new auditing standard entitled Engagement Quality Review. The board received 38 comment letters on this proposal, and in response to the comments, made significant changes to the original proposal. On March 4th of this year, the board reproposed the standard. The comment period for this reproposal ends on April 20th. A transcript of the discussion this morning will be available on our website along with the comment letters that we received. Today we'd like to discuss certain aspects of the proposed standard that generated significant feedback from commenters on the original proposal. In particular, the SAG will discuss questions from the release related to reviewer qualifications, the engagement quality review process, concurring approval of issuance, and documentation of the engagement quality review. So first, let's turn to reviewer qualifications. The board originally proposed to allow the engagement quality reviewer to be a partner or another individual in the firm or an individual outside the firm. In contrast, as described in the release on March 4th, the new proposal would require a reviewer from inside the firm to be a partner or a person in an equivalent position. Like the original proposal, the new proposal would allow a qualified person outside the firm to perform this review. In addition, as under the original proposal, the reviewer must have independence, integrity, and objectivity, and must possess the level of knowledge and competence required to serve as the engagement partner for the same type of engagement. The discussion questions on reviewer qualifications taken from the release are on the slide in front of you. And this is the ones we'd like to talk about first. Is it appropriate to explicitly require a reviewer from within the firm to be a partner or an individual in an equivalent position? Should the standard allow qualified accountants who are not employed by the accounting firm to conduct the review? And then, should the standard prohibit the engagement partner from serving as a reviewer for a period of time following his or her last year as the engagement partner? And then, if so, is 2 years a sufficient time, or should it be extended? So I'd like to go ahead and open up our discussion here on the reviewer qualifications for the engagement quality reviewer.
If you're just for the new members, if you're interested in making comments, we'll try to call on you in order. If you could just please put your name 10 on the side, and we'll get to you.
I'm sorry, Wayne Collins.
Yeah, just thinking on the first one, I think it is appropriate for the reviewer to be a partner, and I would just seek some clarification in terms of what equivalent position means. I assume that if the accounting firm is not organized as a partnership, then we're talking about a name other than a partner, but an equivalent to what a partner would be in a partnership.
Yeah, we explained that in the release. Yes, you are correct, Wayne. That if they're structured like a corporation, then they sometimes referred to as members, and that would be someone in an equivalent position as a partner.
Yeah. And I do think it is appropriate for those that are not employed by the firm, and particularly with respect to smaller accounting firms, they may have a resource issue getting the number of a partner to serve as a concurring reviewer, and it has been the experience for such firms to go outside the firm, perhaps getting an accounting professor, audit professor, or somebody that is very experienced doing these reviews, and I think that's an appropriate objective and requirement of a provision for the standard.
Thank you, Wayne. Hal Schroeder?
I was curious about the second requirement or applicability of hiring somebody from the outside. How do you handle the independence issue? It seems like if you find someone, as just suggested, a professor or someone who develops, I would say, a specialty in being this reviewer, will they become dependent on that stream, and would they tend to shade their views to make sure they have that steady stream of being the reviewer? They may be qualified, but their source of income may make them less than independent.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you, Hal. Galen Hansen?
I would follow up with Wayne's comments. I agree that perhaps some clarification on what equivalent position within the firm means, what maybe a little bit of color on that, if it were. But at the same time, on the other question about the outside reviewer, I think the same standard should apply. I don't know how you have a lesser standard with outside individuals than what you would within the firm. And you know, to follow up with the last comment, I think the independence issue is typically resolved with respect to either that individual's with another registered firm and some sort of independence confirmation that there's independence in fact with that client. On the third question about the prohibition of becoming an engagement quality reviewer after serving as an engagement partner, if you still have years open within the five-year rotation period, I think some break is appropriate. I'm not sure where the 2 years came from or why it was thought that would be appropriate. I would even ask, in the interest of smaller firms that have limited resources, whether a one-year break would be sufficient. I'm not sure, you know, the 2 years is necessary.
Bernard Jarvis?
It's my view also that the engagement quality review is a very important part of the audit and ought to be assigned to a person who is a senior executive in the firm. And that would, in my opinion, be someone at the partner level. And I just addressed the third point. I agree with Galen that perhaps in the case of small firms, 1 year break. I do agree that some break is necessary, and I'd agree that about 1 year would be sufficient.
Other comments on the qualifications of the reviewer? Joe Carcello?
I appreciate the sentiment on the 1 year. The one thing you probably need to think about carefully, though, since your purview is public companies, there's 2 years of balance sheets and 3 years of income statements and cash flow statements in the 10-K. And so if there's a one-year period after someone rolls off being the engagement partner and they come on and they're the engagement quality reviewer, at least some of the financial information and the financial statements that they're going to be reviewing were financial statements that they were responsible for auditing.
Any other comments on the reviewer qualifications? Arnold Schilder.
Thank you, Greg. Just a brief comment. Fully in agreement with what you have done. If I compare it with what the IWSB has done in the quality control standard, we've tried also to define a bit of a general principle, which mentions, as more general principles, sufficient and appropriate technical expertise, experience, and authority, because you can never, let's say, regulate all detailed circumstances. So we thought it was helpful to have a bit of a broader criteria to which against you can judge the more specific criteria. And I would just offer that as a thought that might be helpful in the circumstances.
Thank you, Arnold. If there are no other comments, we can move to the next topic. Let's turn to the engagement quality review process. As described in the release, under the new proposal, like the original proposal, would require evaluation of significant judgments made and conclusions reached by the engagement team and specify certain procedures that the reviewer should always perform. The new proposal provides that the reviewer should perform these procedures through discussions with the engagement team and through the review of documents. Under the original proposal, after performing certain procedures, the reviewer was required to perform additional procedures in higher risk areas of the engagement. This provision is not included in the new proposal because the board believes that the required procedures are sufficient to focus the reviewer on the areas of higher risk. The new proposal describes specific requirements for an engagement quality review of an interim review. These requirements are based on the proposed requirements for an engagement quality review of an audit and are tailored to the different procedures performed in a review of interim financial information. Now let's turn to the questions in the release on the engagement quality review process as on the screen in front of you. Are the descriptions of the scope and extent of engagement quality review procedures contained in the re-proposed standard appropriate? Will the performance of these procedures result in a high-quality engagement quality review? If not, how should these procedures be revised? Are these specifically required procedures appropriately tailored to reflect the difference in scope between an audit and an interim review? And then lastly, do the specifically required procedures sufficiently focus the reviewer on areas of higher risk? Are there other procedures that should be required? I'm going to open up the floor for a discussion of the engagement quality review process itself. Wayne Collins.
One process, part of the process that I'd like to see put in there is some guidance or some principle regarding how the any differences of opinion between the engagement quality reviewer and the engagement partner are worked out.
Okay. Galen Hansen.
I think that resolution process needs to be addressed that Wayne just brought up. The other thing that I think would be helpful is some sort of distinction between materiality with respect to an audit and a 10Q interim review would seem to be would seem to be appropriate in the sense that materiality under audit, and we all struggle with that, and we've had those discussions around this table, but it involves planning and understanding of the system and internal controls, whereas I think there's a little bit different meaning of materiality on interim reviews, and that there doesn't seem to be any kind of distinction with respect to that and how that is addressed. It talks about material modifications in the AU, what is it, 722, and I think if a little bit more was said about that particular distinction, it would be helpful. Randy Fletchall.
Greg, I would just like to comment first to commend the board. I think the revisions that were made from the first version to this version went a long way in clarifying what I think were some concerns about what exactly is the process that the standard is articulating. I think likewise the original version, an audit and interim review were kind of lumped together, and so now I think it's much clearer that those are different service levels and the level of the engagement review is different. Undoubtedly, we will still have a few comments on a few words that we would suggest probably paragraphs 9 and 10, maybe an intro into that section that would give some additional clarification, but I guess I would just say I think this went a long way in solving what we thought were some of the concerns.
Thank you, Randy. Greg Jonas?
I'm a little surprised that the document doesn't give more attention to the issue of timing of the review. In my experience, a key differentiating factor between substantive concurring partner reviews and non-substantive, often the root cause was the concurring partner was in late. And particularly on larger engagements where audits are kind of like aircraft carriers, you don't turn them on a dime, you don't turn them quickly, you got to get a running start. The concurring partner looking at planning shortly after the planning is done, looking at the resolution of major issues as they occur throughout the year, is really an important factor to a quality review. Also, it helps the concurring partner get their head in the game, which is critically important, particularly in complex work. I certainly understand the board's desire not to be too prescriptive about timing. I appreciate that timing, best timing practices differ dramatically from job to job, but I am surprised that it almost walks away from the issue and abdicates any counsel in a standard on what, in my experience, has been mission critical to a quality concurring partner review.
Greg, can I just ask you to expand on what you might think would be appropriate to include, recognizing the standard would be, to be applied but for all public company audits to have an engagement quality review. So you kind of what in your view and the timing would you like to see mentioned, just if you have any more thoughts specifically?
Well, if the document at least talked about the importance of timing, the importance of concurring partners to get in early where desirable, the advantages of doing this, and simply observed that one of the factors that one considers when deciding whether a concurring review was substantive in part relates to the timing. I wasn't thinking more than that.
Thank you.
Liz Fender.
I'm not sure I'm reading it correctly, but I was questioning the differences between the procedures required for an interim review versus an annual review, and I think the wording was trying to make it clear that if you're doing an interim review, you don't have to look at the prior year's disclosures about internal control for the annual review report. And one, is that correct? And two, would you really do that? Would you really review somebody's interims and not take a look at what somebody raised in the prior annual review?
Liz, are you talking about the prior review of a prior quarter, or are you talking about the annual audit?
Yeah, I think the wording says you only have to look at the prior interim information, and so I didn't know if that was meant to say you don't have to look at the prior year's annual audit reports.
Well, the engagement quality viewer would be looking at if he or she's not already familiar with the engagement and what happened in the prior year's audit, because if he or she was new to the engagement, then they would obviously look at prior year's audit and see what the issues were, what the audit issues were, and in carrying out the interim review, they would look at the prior quarter if there's a prior quarter they looked at, then they would look at that to see what the issues are. They want to, because they want to keep current with the issues and know what they are going into that review.
Yeah, I agree with the sentiment. I'm just not sure the words are clear about that. That obviously you do have to familiarize yourself with the engagement, but it, when it was trying to describe the differences between what you're required to do in an interim versus an annual, it sort of said you only have to look at the prior interim.
Okay, we'll look at that, take a and make sure that's clear. Thank you. Doug Anderson.
I had a concern on how the objective is worded and how the procedures in paragraph 10 and paragraph 9 are described. As I read the objective, which I think is a great idea to have a clearly stated objective for the standard in paragraph 2, it seems pretty broad. It looks like we want to make sure that there's a good evaluation of judgment, a good evaluation of conclusions received. As I look at paragraph 10, it talks about in part B that the review should evaluate the risk assessments, the audit responses, meaning the scope of the work. Those all seem pretty broad. As I go back up, though, to paragraph 9, it says you're supposed to do that merely by holding discussions with the engagement team effectively and reviewing documentation. And those, to me, seem to be inconsistent. The objective and what we're trying to get out of this review seems very broad and comprehensive, but then we've limited the procedures. And my concern is that those two things could be considered in conflict, that the external auditing firms will then revert back to what they think the objective is driving, as opposed to what paragraph 9 is saying. So as I look at this, it just seems inconsistent, those two directions in the standard look inconsistent, and either needing more clarification back up in paragraph 2 as to what the objective is, or maybe more clarification in 10B about that.
Well, thank you, Doug. We'll take another look at that, make sure that they are consistent and clear and concise. Bob Dacey.
Thanks, Greg. We, too, appreciate the changes that were made in response to the comments on the earlier draft, but still have some concerns about, at least it's our perception, that some of the other standards, particularly the IAASB, are at a more general principle level than what this would provide in the PCAOB. And again, in this area as well as other areas, just have a concern as to whether or not there's a perception that the general principles stated in some of these other standards are consistent with where you are going or different because of the different terminology that you're using. So we just want to again raise that point, a concern in this area in particular as to whether or not that will create any conflict in application. Thanks.
Hal Schroeder.
Echoing some comments that were made earlier, I am curious myself as to why at least the signing off on the engagement planning portion, it's not encouraged or recommended that it's done concurrent. At the same time, the partner is signed off on it. The reviewing partner should be signing off on the planning before anything substantive is done. Because as I read through the requirements, you don't have any opportunity to make any recommendations or changes. The game's over by the time you get involved. And I would strongly recommend that at least there be two segments to a reviewer's involvement, early in the process and then at the end of the process.
Thank you, Hal. Kurt Schett.
A quick question for those of us not in the profession. I'm curious, how often does the EQR result in a material change, and does the PCAOB, or should it, keep statistics on that so that you have some statistical evidence of how often problems should be found in a particular company's audits?
You can look at some of our inspection reports have cited some findings with respect to the performance or lack of performance, of adequate performance in the engagement quality review, but we don't have any statistics on it. But I'd be interested to hear from the profession, anyone who wants to. Ben Coleman?
Yeah, I'll certainly be brave. That kind of statistic would be very difficult if your objective is a good engagement quality review. I do engagement quality reviews now. And to say, did you catch something, if you're doing it well from the planning through the execution to the final, and you are engaged with the engagement team, you're both independent, but yet you are understanding issues as they arise. So the objective is to avoid looking for the statistic that, you know, you're asking for, because the objective is to get it right before you even, you know, would get into that position, if you're doing your job right, correctly.
Paul Sobel.
Thinking through the 302 disclosure requirements, I do see, and I'm thinking of interim reviews. I think it was covered well for the annual review. There is mention about changes, presumably that's material changes in internal control over financial reporting. I didn't see any specific mention about any frauds that might be identified, committed by management or those involved in the financial reporting process. Is that just considered to be intuitively covered by one of the other items?
Paul, can you explain that? Can you go over that discussion again? I'm not sure I understand what you were.
Okay, if there is an incident of fraud committed by a member of management or those integrally involved in the financial reporting process, it has to be disclosed to the audit committee and the independent outside auditor. I presume even with interim financial statements that might raise questions by the engagement partner, and I wasn't sure how that would be covered then in the EQR in terms of the resolution or conclusions about the impact such a fraud may have on the interim information.
The auditor is clearly under a obligation, a professional obligation. If something comes to their attention, do they have to resolve it? They cannot, have some information before them, and because it has, serious consequences with respect to not only the interim financial statements but also the annual, so they have to resolve any particular issue that might be a fraud indicator.
I understand that, and I guess my question was, as I say, it may be, subsumed in one of these bullet points. Is how does the concurring partner get comfortable with the conclusions of the engagement team with regards to that resolution?
Well, the engagement quality reviewer would have to use, his or her professional judgment, and that's what that individual's duty is to challenge what the team has done, and so they would. He or she would be challenging the team's conclusion on any matter, whether it's a matter that you brought up or any other matter, any audit or accounting issue that they're confronted with. That person is charged with that and has that obligation to make sure that they are concurring with the resolution. Because if they're not, then they need to have a further discussion. They may have to, he or she may have to have additional evidence before he or she concurs.
Yeah, I understand that, so I'm either way off base or not making myself clear. I understand what the process should be. The interim procedures are silent with regards to that, so what I'm hearing you saying is that that would just go along with any of the other judgments, material judgments that are made, and doesn't need to be specifically identified as something that should be on the radar screen of the concurring partner, because again, material changes in internal control are mentioned as one of the items, but fraud is not.
Okay, we'll take another look at that.
Paul, I see fraud mentioned in paragraph 15 regarding interim. I don't know, it's one of the under 15A. Engagement quality reviewer should evaluate the nature of identified risks and material misstatement due to fraud. Does that?
It may. I saw that particular point, and to me that was more forward-looking. What are the risks? What are the potentials? And I was referring to something that was known and identified.
Gary Kabur.
Thank you. This question I thought of when Kurt had raised this question about tracking statistics, if you will, when the engagement reviewer overrules the quality reviewer overrules the engagement partner. The question, did the board consider, or should you consider if you didn't, if there really is a significant override by the concurring partner and a decision has changed, whether it's audit scope or accounting or disclosure decisions, should there be a requirement for communication with the audit committee or the audit, at least the audit committee chairman of that event? Again, I appreciate a lot of this stuff. You know, you'll eventually agree and eventually you'll get the evidence, but there's going to be times, presumably, when, in fact, the engaging team is overruled on something that's important. And from a client service point of view, should there be a requirement for at least the audit committee or the audit committee chairman to be advised of that? I don't know if that's a I don't know if he considered it and rejected it. I'm not even suggesting that should be the answer, but I think it should be considered.
So any instance, then, you're saying, in which the engagement team has arrived at a conclusion and then the engagement quality reviewer would disagree, and then then the ultimate conclusion is in the favor of what the way the engagement quality reviewer wanted to go. And so he or she overrides what the engagement team did.
Yes, correct. And presumably anything they would override them on is on something material to the engagement, whether it's on the audit scope or an accounting conclusion, because this is supposed to be risk-focused. And there, and again, I'm not saying that should be the answer. They advise the audit committee or audit committee chair. I'm just saying, asking, did you consider it? And if you didn't, maybe you could before you finalize it.
Would anyone else like to weigh in on that word? Yes.
It's Galen.
Galen Hansen.
I would be very cautious about using the word override. I think ultimately the engagement partner has to be responsible for the opinion that is issued. He's the final person on the line there. But that doesn't mean to say that engagement quality reviewer, the concurring reviewer, doesn't take that further to the firm's quality control partner, to the director of audit services, whatever the structure is within that firm, to try to get resolution. But I think that resolution aspect is a little bit lacking in the standard. But I'm a little bit antsy about this idea that one person can override another person in its entirety.
Thank you, Galen, and thank you, Gary. Wayne Collins?
On that point, I would also be cautious, and even if the word override is not used, and it's a different word, like maybe if it's a disagreement and the engagement quality reviewer's position is the ultimate position, then you'd have to get involved with the defining disagreements again, which is now in the literature between the issuer and the audit firm. And there's a whole different reason for that in terms of the pressure that may be put to bear, which I don't think exists on the engagement team. I'd also be concerned about, in terms of considering this, what that would do to the mindset of the engagement partner in helping to resolve this disagreement. It may make the engagement partner more obstinate in terms of the resolution.
Jim Cox? Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie Miller, sorry.
I think Gary's point is a good one. And it's really a question to me as to how the governance structure works between the auditor and the preparer. I think the key question is how to determine what would get communicated. And I think perhaps one way to think about it would be to consider whether audit committee communication would be required in situations where a formal resolution process had to be invoked to resolve the disagreement, as opposed to those matters that are resolved in the normal course, you know, through additional audit procedures or additional discussion between the concurring review partner and the audit partner. But I think it is something that ought to receive some level of debate.
Thank you, Jamie. Jim Cox?
I'm sort of struck by the opacity of the second paragraph, which states the objective, and I think if we had less opacity, we would deal with a lot of questions which were started off by Harold's comment about what we really want to have happen here. You can think of a wide range of objectives that could be served within this language, and I think we ought to specify which one of it is we want. One would be make this year's audit better. Another one would be make next year's audit better. A third one could possibly be an internal evaluation of your own staff doing this. A fourth one could be external evaluation of, by the audit committee. I mean, what exactly is the objective of the external quality review? I think if you come to grips with that, many of these questions are on this session would shake out from that. But currently, I think that, again, just to repeat myself here, I'm struck by what I perceive as the opacity of the second paragraph stating what the objectives are. I think it's fairly it's too generalized to be very helpful to somebody who's going to have to govern their conduct as an external reviewer or what to make of the external review going forward.
Thank you, Jim. Joe Carcello.
As some of you know, I've spent a lot of time over the years working with accounting and auditing enforcement releases. And one of the things we've seen in some of those, certainly not the majority, but in some situations where obviously there's ultimately a fraud, and people lower on the engagement team had come across issues that were problematic and were dissuaded from being overly concerned about those issues by people higher on the engagement team. And so my concern ties into paragraph 9, where the last sentence in that paragraph talks about holding discussions with the person with overall responsibility for the engagement, holding discussions with other members of the engagement team as necessary. I guess I would encourage the board to at least think about eliminating the words as necessary. In today's world, with the ubiquity of cell phones, you would not have to have this discussion face-to-face. By the time the second partner review is happening, often members of the engagement team are on to the next job. But you could easily pick up a cell phone and just touch base with everybody on the engagement team to just make sure there wasn't an issue that really troubled them, that they maybe were dissuaded from pushing too hard by others higher up in the chain.
Thank you, Joe. Bob Dacey?
I just wanted to add a point. In terms of our government auditing standards, we wanted to clarify in our latest release that, in fact, the firm ought to have procedures in evaluating or monitoring the quality review process, both in terms of identifying any systemic issues that were identified through quality reviews, as well as where the quality review function is being carried out properly in terms of a monitoring procedure. So just offer that in terms of what we've also addressed to deal with the issues of differences and whether or not things caught in a quality review, how they were dealt with, and again, whether that's a systemic issue in the firm.
Greg Jones.
Greg, I'm about to betray my ignorance, so apologies in advance. Does the new quality control requirement apply to review of work supporting the 404 report on internal control?
Yes.
And that is quite a change in practice relative to current practice for concurring partner reviewers?
No. They currently perform that review of the internal control as well as the audit financial statements.
Is it worth making crystal clear in the final document that if the auditor has an integrated audit, that these requirements apply to that 404 work as well, or was I the only person in the room who was left wondering whether it does or doesn't?
Well, I'll go back and look at it again. I thought it was clear, but we'll make sure it is.
It could be my fault. That could be my fault. Thank you.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on Kurt's question earlier and Professor Cox's comments about the objective. In connection with the PCOB's inspection process, have you identified any issues or concerns regarding the EQR process, and can you tell me what two or three of the main issues or concerns were?
But one of the issues is apparent when you look at some of the inspection reports. The question that presents itself is, you know, once you see the deficiencies that have been identified, then you obviously you ask yourself, you know, why didn't the engagement quality reviewer detect some of these deficiencies? I mean, that's paramount with not all the inspection findings, but some of them you'll see that, and we make that clear in some of the reports that. Another issue that comes up is the documentation of the engagement quality review process. It's we have noted that in the reports that it's not sufficient to indicate what the person did and what the person reviewed and what, you know, what conclusion they arrived at, because it's hard to tell what they actually, if they did anything at all. So those are just a couple of findings I would note. Any other comments on the engagement? Yes, Tom?
I've just given some more thought to the question about whether there should be a requirement for communication to the audit committee if there's disagreements or, again, I understand the word override is probably a little inflammatory, but for lack of a better word right now, I just think you need to really consider what the objective of that communication would be. Because as I think more about it, if an auditor in a firm is carrying out the work outlined in the standards such that the reviewing individual can issue the concurring report, then from an audit committee standpoint, the audit committee should be satisfied that the work was done and not be concerned about the inner workings within the audit firm that led to that conclusion. Not any different than for a preparer, if there are debates and dialogues within a company as it's preparing its financial statements. I just think to the extent the board considers a requirement there, you'd be very explicit as to what the objective would be, because otherwise I think you could get into a very inefficient process and a very slippery slope there in terms of what's coming back to the audit committee.